I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The film critics are here today with a lineup of independent, foreign, and documentary movies like we haven't seen in quite a while. We'll go to India for the last days of British rule. We'll follow a ballerina pursuing her dream in Russia. And then we'll come back for a feature filmed entirely in Kansas City. Hear our reviewers' thoughts on Ben Stiller, Jake Gyllenhaal, and Emma Stone in their latest roles, and find out how Hugh Bonneville does playing real-life royalty. From a mystery that results when a doctor doesn't answer her door, to a biopic of J.D. Salinger, to a road movie set in Lakota country, the critics take us through the films showing in area theaters. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Well, another crop of independent foreign and documentary films is out to keep us going through this fall season, and joining us now to talk about them is our usual crew of outstanding observers of culture, Cindy Haynes, the film professor and critic. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning.
Good to see you. KCUR's own Steve Walker.
Hi, Brian. Nice to be here.
And the man who reviews film for the Kansas City Star, Bob Butler. You can read his reviews 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at butlercinemascene.com. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
It's good to have you all here. And we get to start this week with a little local flavor, right, Steve?
Absolutely. And it popped out of nowhere, as far as I could tell. I saw that this movie was opening at AMC. I hadn't seen it. It looked like an indie. Lo and behold, it's called Different Flowers. It was directed by Morgan Damron, who is a Kansas City native. She went to Pembroke. She grew up in the Northland.
But it's her first film.
It is her first film as the director. Yes, she has worked on several Star Wars films with Abrams. This is a story about two sisters who, one of them jilts her husband at the altar in the first couple minutes.
Husband-to-be.
Husband-to-be, right. They don't even get to the vows. And takes off, and she hauls her in a truck outside and out into the country, in and around Kansas City. And they just kind of spar a little bit. They're sisters. I have a sister, and that's another story, but sisters have a contemptuous relationship, sometimes complicated. And I think these two young actresses, Emma Bell and Hope Lauren, do a really fine job of establishing some chemistry. You actually could believe that these young ladies are sisters.
Yeah, the free spirit versus the more uptight sister. That's kind of a classic combination.
What's kind of fun is watching things that pop up that you'll notice, like the city's their skyline of downtown is shot.
Kansas City has never looked better.
It looks great, yeah. Really? And the wedding scene was filmed at Ward Country Club Christian Church on Ward Parkway. She told me, and this I'm spoiling a little movie magic here, not the end of the movie, but I asked her via email, where did you film and where was this? And she said, well, the town that they go to, the small town, is kind of a mix of Weston, Missouri, McGonagall's grocery store on Ward Parkway, and a diner in the West Bottoms.
No kidding.
All kind of stand in for, in a believable way, all the little businesses in this town.
You know, our KCUR review of this movie said that the director set out to make it a love letter to the heartland. Does it come off that way?
It does.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. The only really name actress in it is Shelley Long, who people may remember from Cheers.
She produced it.
She also produced it.
She plays the young lady's grandmother, Rosie Rosemont, who was on Glee, played one of the moms there. She plays the mom. And I really enjoyed it. We see so much middling stuff that I was with it from the moment it started.
So I understand we have a clip from this film.
We do. This was a clip of the two sisters in the diner, filmed in the West Bottoms.
All right. Well, let's take a listen to this little bit of Different Flowers.
What? Everyone is staring at me. Nobody here gives a hoot about you. Wow, thanks.
Tough love, baby dove.
Should I call Charlie?
What?
Just, you know, check in.
No. You don't leave a man at the altar and then grovel at his feet. Woman up, Millie.
It's, I believe, Emma Bell and Hope Laurie.
And in that diner scene is an actress many of you will know from Kansas City stages, Nancy Marcy, who plays a biker chick.
Sounds like a great scene.
The show, the movie opens today at the AMC Town Center 20 and the Barry Woods 24. And Morgan will be doing a Q&A session this Sunday after the 5:10 showing at the Town Center and 7 p.m. at the Barry Woods 24. So please go out and support this independent filmmaker. She's done a great job. I think she has a great future as a filmmaker.
Nice when they can come back and talk about them in their hometown.
Right.
That's great. Well, that's Different Flowers. Let's move on to our next film. And this is one I've been hearing about a little bit, at least on NPR, called Battle of the Sexes. This is a story about Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs and their very famous tennis match, Bob.
Well, the film was directed by Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, who gave us Little Miss Sunshine, one of the great independent comedies of recent years. So the material's in good hands. What they're required to do here is balance personal stories against a rather large landscape of cultural change. Early 70s, women's liberation is kind of a new thing. Bobby Riggs, a former tennis champ who is living a life of utter boredom in his retirement, he has a make-do job at his father-in-law's firm. He goes out and gambles on anything. He will play a game of tennis with two Afghans on leashes just so he can make money. His wife makes him go to Gamblers Anonymous, but then he announces that you people aren't here because you're gamblers. You're here because you're bad gamblers. Face it, winners don't need support groups.
That's an unhealthy guy. Understanding of
now,
addiction, yes.
He's played here by Steve Carell, and it would be easy for this to become the Bobby Riggs story because he's such a colorful, flamboyant, crazy son of a gun. Opposite him is Emma Stone as Billie Jean King, who by comparison only wanted to play tennis and get an even break at the prize money. And in a sense, this could have tilted so heavily toward Bobby Riggs that she became a cipher. But Emma Stone, as we should know by now, she won the Oscar last year, is a tremendous actress. And she makes this kind of, in a way, the story of the gentle radicalization of a woman who really didn't want to be a radical in any way, shape, or form. It also is almost, but not quite, a coming out story because while on the Virginia Slims all-woman tour, she finds herself in a romantic relationship with a female hairdresser. She's happily married, and in fact, after the great tennis match that climaxes the film, she went back to her husband, and it was several years before she officially decided, yeah, I guess I'm gay. So it isn't, there's a lot going on here. What can I tell you? The setting, the recreation of the early 70s, and I remember it very clearly, very right on.
Well, and I don't remember it very clearly, Bob, but I will say that this was a much bigger deal than I think a younger generation realizes it could possibly have been.
People who see this movie will realize that there was not a water cooler in America that was not practically melting down from the conversations surrounding
Bob,
it about this.
90 million people watched this match on television.
That's hard to imagine.
It was
now.
That big a deal.
Now, we got a great clip here. This is Bobby Riggs, of course, played by Steve Carell, calling up Billie Jean in the middle of the night at her hotel in San Diego and proposing this madcap nutso idea.
Let's listen to a little bit of Battle of the Sexes.
It's Bobby Riggs.
Bobby? How'd you get my number?
Called every hotel in San Diego. Listen, I had a great idea.
Okay. Well, it's after midnight, Bobby, so can we talk another time?
You and me, Billie Jean. 3 cents, 5 cents, your choice.
Are you drunk, Bobby?
No, of course not. How about this? Man versus woman. Male chauvinist pig versus hairy-legged feminist. No offense. You're still a feminist, right?
No, I'm a tennis player who happens to be a woman.
That's right. That's exactly who you are. And I am a tennis player who happens to be a man. Who says that he can beat any woman on the planet? Think of the publicity that we get. Think of the money.
No.
35 grand.
Where'd you get the kind of money?
You see? You're tempted.
I'm really not. I'm not interested, Bobby. Good night.
Don't hang up. Don't hang up.
By the way, I shaved my legs.
I'd like to...
That is funny.
That is funny. Now, those who think this is just going to be all lightweight nostalgia, this movie's got bite, And you come out of it saying, wow, that was 30 years ago. And in some ways, things haven't changed all that much. In fact, we may be regressing. So there's teeth in this as well.
Is it pretty true to the historical
facts? As far as I
can
tell, it is dead on, even to the point of recreating press conferences. And Bobby Riggs, how obnoxious was Bobby Riggs? Do you remember Burt Reynolds' nude centerfold in Ms. Magazine?
Well, not personally. No, but...
He recreated it to promote the match. He's just a wild man.
Wow. Okay, so that's Battle of the Sexes. They can catch that at the Glenwood, right?
Oh, it's all over the place, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty wide.
It's wide. Yeah.
All right, very good. Next up, we've got a film about a doctor who doesn't answer the doorbell at her clinic, but that's turns out to be a bad choice because she learns that the woman who she doesn't let in, well, she's found dead, Steve.
Right. This is from Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne, who are Belgian filmmakers. Every one of their movies I've loved. And that's not an exaggeration. From 2 Days, One Night, a couple years ago, with Marion Cotillard, L'Enfant, The Kid with the Bike. They make incredible movies without a lot of bangs and whistles. It's just about people and their stories.
And they're always profound.
Always. And this young woman's a doctor. She's worked a long day at a clinic.
I should say, I didn't give the title. It's called The Unknown Girl.
The Unknown Girl. Yep. The title character is the woman who's an immigrant. To Belgium, who rings their doorbell at the end of a very long day. The hours, they're way working overtime. The clinic's closed, and they decide, it's like a split-second decision. We make 14,000 times a day about different things. They decide, let's not answer it. And the woman is found dead the next day. And so this young woman is profoundly affected by this and begins to do some homework in the little Belgian town where they live, so the woman isn't buried as a nameless corpse. It becomes sort of a detective story through the doctor's eyes. And her name is Adele Heinel. She's amazing.
I like the idea of a story where people who aren't detectives end up becoming detectives. It's a little Murder, She Wrote.
Well, she feels guilty, obviously, because if she'd answered the door, maybe this woman wouldn't be dead.
Yeah. What do you think, Cindy?
It's one of my favorite movies of the year. It really is.
Why is
wonderful. Just what Steve was addressing here, how profound it is, how sensitive it is, great acting. And I just, these are phenomenal filmmakers, and they've hit another home run here with The Unknown Girl.
All right. The Unknown Girl. It's at the Tivoli.
It's at the Tivoli, where this week, interestingly enough, all three of the films there at Jerry's Tivoli are in foreign languages. So don't let people tell you foreign films are dying. They're not.
So if you want to practice your French, go see The Unknown Girl.
And you can practice some other languages at the Tivoli as well. We'll get to those films.
Right.
But that's playing now. Next up, we've got a movie called Polina about, a teenager who, when a teenager, she is a talented young Russian ballerina. She decides to pursue modern dance and choreography, and then her life starts to change, Steve.
Yes, this too is on my three to see for this week. It's really a wonderfully made film. When she's in her nine or 10 or 11, her father does some underhanded deals to get money to allow her to go to this school that prepares her for the Bolshoi Ballet, which she gets into. And then we flash forward a few years, and she is in her upper teens, probably, and she falls in love and moves to Aix-en-Provence in France to follow her dreams of being with this young male dancer, and following her dreams of maybe ballet is not what I want to do. I have more contemporary beats in my heart, if you will.
And the family has sacrificed everything
for her, and
they envision her being a star in the Bolshoi Ballet.
And she ends up working for a company that's very radical and contemporary, who's run by Juliette Binoche.
She's wonderful.
Who's maybe the biggest name actor in this film, right?
Yeah.
I have a totally different take on this film.
Oh, interesting.
I do not think that this is really a movie about dance per se. Early on, when she's a little girl, her first instructor berates her. He says, you're bringing all your emotions, all your problems at home to the studio. Get rid of them. And as a result, this young woman grows up being essentially stoic. And all of the other modern dance people she runs into keep telling her, Your technique's great, but there's no passion. There's nothing there. Come on.
Right.
So this is about her eventually, over the course of several years, finally finding a dance style that allows her to free herself. And it ends with an absolutely drop-dead beautiful dance for two people at the end of the film. Now, I have to say I have a problem in that the young lady who's the actress, what's her name, who plays
her name is tough. It's Anastasia Shevtsova.
If anything, you
Well done, Steve.
Thank you.
Playing a buttoned-down emotional character is tough to begin with. Great actors can find ways to open it up so that you can sense what's going on. She was an enigma to me.
Really?
Yeah.
So didn't which you're holding the acting responsible for that?
In a sense, yeah. I it's like I understand the arc of the film. I just didn't feel the arc of the film.
Go ahead, Cindy.
No, it's interesting that after the film, that young actress was admitted to the famous Minsky Ballet in St. Petersburg.
Well, you can tell she's a dancer.
And But it's, for me, it was also the story of being a creative person and what it took.
And self-expression.
There's beautiful dancing in it. It's just exciting, energizing dancing. And there's a beautiful scene when she's like 10, walking home from class in the snow, after a day of classical ballet training, and she just starts like this hip-hop thing going on that only she is participating in. She's the only audience to
and
it.
And brings her joy. Great joy.
And it brought me so much joy. It reminded me of Billy Elliot the first time I saw that.
I wondered if there was a Billy Elliot parallel.
There is in the first 20 minutes or so, for sure.
I was also intrigued by that this film is based on a graphic novel.
That's
the source material.
Yeah. I have not seen it, but I read that this week. I said, well, this is interesting. Yeah.
That's a different way of developing characters.
A graphic novel about dance. How does that work?
Yeah, right.
It does. In this case, it does.
And one more note that I noticed that Philip Glass wrote at least part of the score.
I wasn't aware of that.
I wasn't aware of that myself. So I sometimes don't stay for the very last credit.
Okay. Well, that's a little true insight into that. Steve Walker that we get there today.
Not so much.
That is Steve Walker. Cindy Haynes and Bob Butler are here. We're talking about the latest in documentary, indie, and foreign films. That's another of those foreign films at the Tivoli this week. And here's one more. It's called The Fencer. It's about a fencer who hides from the Russian secret police by becoming a teacher in his hometown of Estonia. And this one's kind of special to you, Cindy.
Well, it is. My mother was born and raised in Latvia, and it's one of the three Baltic countries that suffered under the Germans and the Russians and became independent. And it's a story based on the life of an Estonian fencer, Endel Nelis, who was born in 1925 and died in 1993. And he's a hero in Estonia. The film follows a somewhat traditional narrative, sports narrative, with the question is, will the underdogs survive?
Go to the big tournament, yeah.
It's the Estonian Hoosiers, is that what you're saying?
There you go. Only with that pays instead of basketballs.
Right.
Yeah.
I read that in a review, by the way. I didn't make that up.
And with a serious undercurrent of politics, too.
Well, he's hiding out. The reason he's doing this is because he's a wanted man. As a teenager, he and the other boys in his town were recruited by the Nazis and inducted into the army. They didn't want to be there. Our hero ran away, but since then, it's a Stalinist period. You know, and if you had anything to do with the Germans, you were dead meat. So he's changed his name and he's living incognito, basically trying to survive.
And he risks everything being found out by taking these kids to the tournament, which is not in Estonia.
It's in Leningrad.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. I really enjoyed it. I think it's so traditional of a sports movie with, like you said.
I was telling Cindy, you know, it's funny how you can take it something that would be cliched in English and in a foreign language, it's fresh.
Well, even if the Nazis are underlying the story, it's not so fresh.
Yeah.
Really.
This was up for an Oscar. It was the Finnish submission for Best Foreign Film.
I think that was also politics as to who was going to lay claim to this film. But yes, it's gotten a lot of international attention, and I do think it's really worth seeing.
Does it air more on the side of sort of the sports narrative or more the political thriller?
I think there's a
good
balance.
This guy's living a life of almost he's almost a hermit. he doesn't want people to know him. He admits he doesn't get along with kids, you know. So there's a real sense of a person hiding out.
Yeah, actually sounds like a pretty interesting film to go see. That's The Fencer, playing now at the Tivoli, one of their three foreign films where you can brush up on all of your European languages.
And that's Estonian, Russian, and Armenian.
All of those
in there.
If you
go see The Fencer.
Well, very good. So check it out at the Tivoli. When we come back, we will keep talking about the best in independent, foreign, and documentary films. We've got a road movie about a trip through Lakota country. We've got an angsty nonprofit director obsessing about all his college friends being more successful than him. Feels a little too close to home for me, but we'll deal with that. Also, film festivals that are coming up. So stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we learned what President Trump's DACA deadline means for area dreamers. We also received an update on recovery efforts in Florida and Puerto Rico. You can find those conversations at kcur.org. Steve Kraske will be back here on Monday, and he'll discuss what an 18-year-old Ernest Hemingway was like with local author Steve Paul. We'll also learn about the future of online grocery shopping, so join us Monday at 11 for that. Today we're talking about the latest in independent, foreign, and documentary films with our usual crew, KCUR's own Steve Walker, the once and forever film professor and critic Cindy Haynes, and the Kansas City Star's Bob Butler. We've talked about a few already, but we're switching away from the foreign films now to a movie that you've probably heard about in the theaters called Stronger, based on a hero of the Boston Marathon bombing, Bob.
I got to admit, I went into this with misgivings.
Yeah.
Was this going to be what? Patriotic? A flag waver? Was it going to be a sob fest? Was it going to be, help us all,
sweet,
inspirational?
Yeah.
And the story had already been told in the Patriots Day with
more condensed version.
Right.
Well, this is the story of Jeff Bauman, who lost both legs in the marathon bombing in Boston. He's played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who is trolling for an Oscar big time, folks. I will tell you that there are at least five times in this movie when I was utterly overwhelmed. And I don't expect to get overwhelmed that easily. This
We were too.
This just I'm
was
glad
too.
To hear it, guys. As I told a friend, if you don't cry at least three times in this movie, you should stop buying movie tickets and start saving for a bass boat. because, you know, art is not your thing.
Jake Gyllenhaal pulls it off.
What makes this so interesting is it's about him, yes. It's about his longtime girlfriend, played by Orphan Black's Tatiana Maslany, who's a tremendous actress if you've seen that TV show. His mom, played by Brit actress Miranda Richardson. Remember The Fighter with Mark Wahlberg and his scheming, brawling, slightly perverse family?
Melissa Leo won the Oscar for that role.
She did. It's the same kind of thing. His mother is a boozy divorcee who, as soon as her son becomes an invalid, immediately starts playing the mother card big time.
With a great Boston accent.
With a great Boston accent.
She's amazing.
It's a fantastic portrait of working class Boston, among other things. So what we've got here is we have a clip in which Jake Gyllenhaal's character, Jeff Bauman, is just gotten his new prosthetic legs and is struggling to make it all work.
Let's listen to Stronger.
Up, hips back, chest up.
Jeffy.
Chest up. Okay. Chest up. Chest up. Good. Okay.
That's amazing.
Good.
Okay. Dad, you are so tall.
All right. Okay.
Gosh, I'm that little soil.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Okay. Any needles on my legs. Okay.
But you look awesome.
Good job,
Jeff. Amazing, Jeffy. This looks amazing. Keep going.
It's the first time.
Keep going.
I can't.
Let him sit.
I gotta sit down.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Good job.
Gosh, even the audio is very powerful.
Yeah, this was directed by David Gordon Green, whose past work ranges from stuff like stoner comedies, Your Highness, to one of the great indie films of recent years, Prince Avalanche, with Kansas City's own Paul Rudd.
And George Washington.
And George Washington. Yeah. I think this may be one of the best things he's ever done.
I will say, we want to explain that he was there not to race, but he was there to try to get his girlfriend back, who was running the marathon. Mm-hmm. He was standing over there, and there's a scene where he sees the backpack being set on the sidewalk, which is pretty powerful.
In fact, as soon as he came out of his coma, he called the FBI in and said, I saw
right,
the guy.
Right.
And that's all true.
That's all true.
Yes. And Brian, you called him a hero in introducing it. This is what drove him crazy and really contributed to some struggles with drugs and other things.
We're talking PTSD here.
I'm not a hero. I've lost my legs. What makes me a hero? And this is the part of the key to Jake Gyllenhaal's multi-level performance. Yeah.
How does the film handle the moment of the explosion?
You know, you think it's going to start with that. What you see is the explosion from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
His girlfriend, the race ends for her. She goes to a bar, and there on the TV, she sees her boyfriend being carried away by
right.
a guy in a cowboy hat.
Right.
So you don't actually see the bombing. It isn't recreated until the third act of the movie in flashbacks. So
when it is in very graphic
Yeah, but
detail.
Instead of rubbing yeah. your nose in it right off the bat, which would be the normal way of doing it,
right.
they saved that to point out just why this guy is suffering mentally as well as physically.
Well, and that credit goes to David Gordon Green,
who does
an amazing job. The cinematography keeps you close, right in their faces. Something that's rather rare is Green cast actual doctors and nurses in parts as extras, which gives you almost a documentary feel, a sense of reality that as I mentioned before, this Mark Wahlberg version, Patriot's Day, just didn't have. So I highly recommend it. I think it's amazing that all three of us, three very different people, all shed tears watching this film.
That's the movie Stronger. Not going to have any trouble finding that in a theater.
No, it's not playing as wide as you would think, though.
Yeah, Glenwood has it.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, a film called Rebel in the Rye. And as you might expect from the title, it is about the writer J.D. Salinger.
It is. And that's a horrible title, by the way.
Is it really?
Well, yes.
As you see. Well,
hokey,
all right.
So. Hokey.
Well, let's figure out what this is about. Bob, what's this about?
Oh, I think I'm doing it.
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
It's about J.D. Salinger, and it covers him from a young man who's going to college and wants to be a writer. He ends up going to World War II, where he suffers from some PTSD.
Yeah, definitely.
They called it shell shock back then. And then he goes to college and meets Kevin Spacey. He's played by Nicholas Holt. I want to say that.
Yeah.
If you remember About a Boy with Hugh Grant.
Mm-hmm. He was the boy.
He was the little boy.
He was the boy it was about.
He's grown up to be a very handsome young man. And so he plays Salinger, who's kind of a horn dog. But he's a very talented writer. And this is one of the performances of Kevin Spacey's that I've really liked. I don't care for him, usually.
Really?
Well, but he and Spacey really kind of become buds.
Spacey is his professor, right?
Yes.
His mentor.
His writing mentor. And that's with Salinger, that was a somewhat treacherous thing to be, because Salinger, once he wrote it, he figured it was perfect. It was done. Don't tell me. I don't want notes, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. He starts to get published in The New Yorker, and then Spacey goes, go back to that. Remember that story you started in class about this Holden Caulfield? I think you need to go back to it.
Right, because he's been writing short stories. And this is the Spacey's character is the one who says, this is a book.
And movies about writers can be so boring.
Yeah.
And so academic and so in the head. But I found Nicholas Holt
impressive. Especially since this is Salinger, for all his talent, was a very prickly character.
And nobody really knew him
He was a guy who could be, you know, really overwhelming and egotistical. And
first film for director Danny Strong.
And I think that's kind of part of the problem of the film, that he just doesn't have the chops yet.
Who's Danny Strong? Remind me. I'm sorry.
He was the creator of Empire, right?
I think.
Not familiar with it.
Yeah, but didn't you have some criticisms of this film, Cindy?
Yeah, as you know, blaming it on him as director, as opposed to Nicholas Hoult, who I think did a very credible job in the film.
I loved something I heard Danny Strong say about this. He said on Nightline, I think it was, that making this film about J.D. Salinger is the last thing J.D. Salinger would have wanted. He would have, quote, sued the hell out of him.
Yeah, exactly.
Was he as secretive as Pynchon and other writers?
Pretty much.
Right. He became a recluse for the last, I don't know, 50 years of his life, I think. So this is an interesting story to tell.
And I believe a young woman wrote a book about...
Joyce Maynard.
Yeah.
She was his teenage mistress. Woo!
And that upset him something fierce.
It's fun to see New York captured in that period. I love watching films set in New York in the
40s, 50s.
Love it. And they do a really nice job capturing that as well.
The film is Rebel in the Rye. It opened last week at the Glenwood.
Should we come up with a better title?
Well, what would you... Do you have one in mind,
you know why,
Steve?
They did it? Because they knew that Salinger fans would immediately glom onto that title and it would tell them...
How about The Catcher? I don't know.
Okay,
I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll submit that and see if they want to change it.
I'm sure that'll be coming
for the next release. So that's open now. Also, another one out last week called Brad's Status. This is the one about the nonprofit leader who's having some questions about life choices he's made. Right, Cindy?
Right. And I looked at all the praise for this film and calling it a genius of a film and one of the funniest things that's been released this year. And I just found it tedious, frustrating. I mean, I don't know if it's a male-female thing, but bunch of men in midlife, well, not a bunch, but Ben Stiller, who is neurotic, he's obsessive, he's concerned that, in fact, he is not as successful as the men he went to college with. And his young son is in the process of going to college, and so Stiller's character wants to live through him. And it was just very frustrating to hear him moan and complain about a life that he was so privileged to lead.
Just hearing you describe it, it feels a little formulaic. This midlife crisis, taking the kid to college, questioning one's life choices.
Right.
Yeah. So we actually have a clip. We can listen to a little bit of this film. What are we going to hear?
It's, in fact, Ben Stiller's character talking to his son, Troy, about going to Harvard.
Let's take a listen.
You're going to Harvard?
Well, maybe, I don't know.
Does your mother know about this?
Oh, she knows I want to.
I can't believe I didn't know about this.
What do you mean you knew that we were coming here?
I knew we were checking out the school, but I didn't know you were actually going to get in.
Why am I not getting?
But it seems like you might.
Oh, yeah, I might.
The kid's going to Harvard.
They'll jinx me, dude. You all right?
Yeah. Life's crazy, huh? I mean, how cool. I'm proud of you.
Well, that dialogue did not overly impress me, Steve.
You look like you were about to fall asleep, as I did in the first half of this movie. I agree with Cynthia. The whiny, it made me wonder about the Book of Lamentations in the Bible.
Ah.
Is that a book that's full of...
The Book of Lamentations is actually a lot more exciting than...
Well, it made me want to go reference it and go look at it, because if this is what lamenting things are about, it's not cinematically interesting.
You know,
it's not funny. It's because I'm not in Ben Stiller's character's skin. The only thing I'll say in its favor... And I have to say, a cinephile friend of mine who loves movies saw it and thinks it's just a masterpiece.
There are people out there who...
And I went, really? Okay. In its favor, all of his whining about all of his friends have succeeded far over what he has. you get to him seeing them and talking with them, and no, everything's not as rosy as you picture it to be.
Right.
Everything's not what you've imagined it is from your position not having connected to us in 15 years.
Yeah.
Things are much more complicated.
Well, and I will say, I do feel like there is there's a nugget in that storyline that I think really does resonate for a lot of people, and maybe this is the point where I will disclose on air that I went to Harvard and I'm a nonprofit executive. And you gather with other graduates, and you do sometimes have at least those fleeting thoughts, like, wow, I could be making more money, I could be have a longer list of achievements, and I think a lot of people do feel that way.
Well, the grass is always greener. Yeah. We've heard that story since we were in kindergarten, and here's a 50-year-old, 47-year-old man doing the same thing. And he's called on his white privilege. They do have a scene with a student at Harvard who knows his son.
Who kind of
calls him on it. It's going, oh, mister. And she's, I believe she's Middle Eastern?
Yes.
Okay. So they touch on that a little bit, but they're dipping one toe into white privilege.
Yeah.
And then pulling it out again. Point. Right.
Interesting.
Right.
So he's scolded by this young student who is much more sensitive, aware, and attuned to the world than Ben Stiller's character. And his advice to her after hearing all of this is that sell out as soon as you can. That if you want to succeed in life.
But then, to up the creep factor, he then imagines himself frolicking on the beach
with her
and her friend in their bathing suits.
The plot is fueled by social media. And I think that's, you know, one of the rare nuggets in this film, is that you see the impact of you know, revealing people's lives using social media and not getting the right picture.
But it's not done well, like Ingrid Goes West knocked out of the ballpark a couple months ago.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. Well, Cindy and Steve, not especially encouraging you to go see Brad's Status, but you can if you want. That opened at the Glenwood last week.
Ultimately, the bottom line, isn't
it? No, it's always up to you. Next up, though, a show that has been out for a little bit is out at Liberty Hall now, called Viceroy's House, an historical epic set in 1947 about India's independence from Britain. Cindy, make a case.
This is a film I highly recommend. This is a film worth watching. After three centuries in India, it's an amazing history lesson. I thought, in fact, I knew that story, but I'm assuming it's accurate in its tale of the British leaving India and turning it over
to India.
Yeah. And the politics involved, there were so many echoes for me. I've just finished watching the Vietnam War series on PBS, and the echoes to this story in the 1940s in Vietnam, and also what's going on in the Middle East, is just eerie.
Your Downton Abbey fans will be interested to know that
Hugh,
what's his
last name?
Bonneville plays Lord Mountbatten, who was
Lord Grantham, now playing real life royalty.
And he was sent to India basically to shut it down. He was the last viceroy of India. And he and his wife, played by the X-Files, Gillian Anderson,
right.
They, in a culture that is all snobbery and, you know, they are actually doing their best to understand the Indian people and come to a conclusion that will make everybody happy. And it's impossible because you've got a country that's three quarters Hindu, one quarter Muslim. It's going to mean dividing the country. People who live in what will become Pakistan who are Hindi have to race back across the border and vice versa. There are mobs killing each other. Even inside Viceroy House, which has something like 500 employees, there are people sabotaging each other over religion. And at one point, the Viceroy has to call everybody together and read the Riot Act.
But it's not done in a didactic in teachy way. It's really told through the stories of these people who are really interesting characters.
Well, you've got Gandhi in it. You've got Nehru. You've got all sorts of people.
It's a pretty important historic time.
Oh,
really,
to say the least.
We have a clip from the film, too, right?
Yes. We have Lord Mountbatten getting his marching orders from Churchill.
This is Viceroy's House.
Now, Attlee's told you of the task.
Yes.
What their decision on a boundary line dividing 90 million Muslims, Sikhs and Hindus.
Quite so. Tea with milk.
And you want it by August 15th?
Actually, that's one day shy. I've agreed to move the date up to midnight of August the 14th to satisfy the astrologers.
That's less than 5 weeks.
You'll have a small team working with you. They'll be representing all the parties concerned.
We'll provide you with maps, census figures, geographical data, and any other information you require.
You're asking me to draw a line through people's houses, rice paddies, jute fields.
Look, I understand. It's a daunting proposition, yes. And we all accept, you know, that some anomalies will be inevitable.
Radcliffe, how well do you know Bengal and the Punjab?
I assume Pug would have told you, sir. I've never set foot in India in my life.
And that's Viceroy's house.
You know, this does not make the British government look good at all. It is strongly suggested that Churchill's government was sabotaging this whole effort along the way.
But it makes the Viceroy and his wife look very good, because they are told when they show up, you're not to talk to the servants, you're not to have them to dinner. And she's like, don't tell me what to do. I will do what my heart tells me to do.
Yeah.
It's at the Glenwood as well.
There's an interesting, just to kind of dramatize it even further, there's a love affair between a Hindu man and a Muslim girl who are torn apart by circumstances. So you get that Romeo and Juliet thing going too.
Yeah.
The partition of India led to the largest mass migration in human history, something I didn't know. 14 million people were displaced, and 1 million Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs died during this time.
Can we give a shout-out to the director? I don't have it in my notes.
Gurinder Chadha. I was going to get to that. At the end of the film, she directed Bend It Like Beckham, Bride and Prejudice. In the end credits, she relates the fact that her relatives were affected by this partition, including her grandmother, who eventually reunited with her husband in a refugee camp.
In fact,
so you get that information at the end of the film.
You get the sense that the romantic couple in the movie were based on her own grandparents.
Right.
Yes.
Wow. That's Viceroy's house, open at Liberty Hall.
Beautifully shot. I mean, should we put David Lean in the...
David
Lean.
Very
lush. Yeah. It's also, I just want to say, at the Rio in Overland Park.
Thank you. Yes. Very good. One more film to talk about this week, and that is Neither Wolf Nor Dog, which is a great title to start with. Cindy, what's this?
I'll take that one.
What's this about, Bob?
Who hasn't wanted to sit at the feet of a wise old Native American and get all sorts of mystical, information and inspiration? Well, this is a very small budget film shot on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. It's based on a semi-autobiographical novel by Kent Nerburn, who became basically the acolyte of a old Native American named Dan. Dan is played by David Bald Eagle. He was 95 when he made this. He only died last year, and he's terrific. Now, the film, I think, wants to de-romanticize our vision of, Indians.
Right.
It comes very close to doing just the opposite, but that's okay. Basically, what happens is Dan and his sort of grumpy, white, mistrusting buddy, Grover, played by Richard Ray Whitman, they more or less kidnap this white interloper and take him on a tour of Sioux country. They're driving around in an old car, and he's learning stuff in a way.
As we are.
I think the whole point of this is to show that Native American life is not simple, that there's a lot going on, that there are many currents, some of them conflicting. And
it's not Dances with Wolves.
It is not Dances with Wolves. Absolutely not. But there are the things you would expect, like there's a visit to a small town museum, which, of course, is run by white people, and
Do you know that the
Native Americans are just looking at this going, oh, my God.
The woman playing the at the counter is the actual wife of Dan.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well,
which adds a whole other dimension to this story.
No kidding.
We do have a short clip from this film.
Well, this is Dan on the road and giving some wisdom.
This is Neither Wolf Nor Dog.
No Indian alive dares to think too much for the past. The bones of my people are crying. Our people never had a chance. The soldiers attack us in our homes. They kill our little boys, little bitty girls. And rode away laughing.
You know, that makes it sound a lot grimmer than it is.
Right,
that,
right. He's fun to watch.
He is
the
fun
movie
to watch.
Kind of borders on amateur hour a
but,
little bit.
But, you know, it, behind it all, it's kind of a crash course in modern Indian ethos. So if you want to get your head turned around a little bit, this is a way to do it.
That's neither wolf nor dog. Go ahead, Cindy. One last thing
I just
want
to mention that it was funded by a Kickstarter campaign.
Oh.
And that seems to be the way a lot of filmmakers are going these days. Is you just put it out there on the internet, and if people are sympathetic to your story or that you want to tell, that's where you're going to find funding these days.
Seems like a nerve-wracking way to count on your revenues. Before we go today, we want to highlight a couple of local film events that are coming up.
The Universal Film Festival runs today and tomorrow at the B&B Theater, 8601 West 135th Street in Kansas City, Missouri. For details about their 30 films that will be shown, and for details, times, and films, go to universalfilmfestival.com.
And I'm very excited to hear about the New York City Dog Film Festival.
Well, you asked, is it for dogs or does it feature dogs?
Right,
yes.
Or both.
It's a wonderful series of films about dogs. And just go to the Tivoli website.
But probably not Amores Perros.
No.
Well, goodness. There just aren't enough film festivals for dogs. But we'll keep looking for those. A few films coming up you want to just mention real quick, Cindy?
Victoria and Abdul opens October the 6th. It's another one of those Judi Dench stars. And The Work, a documentary about rehabilitating prisoners at Folsom Prison, and Ex Libris, a three-hour documentary by Fred Weissman, will be showing at the Tivoli October 13th.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week on our this month on our independent foreign and documentary film show. Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, Bob Butler, thank you all for being
thank
here
you.
Today.
Yep.
Always a pleasure. Don't forget our podcasts and previous programs are at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter at @kcuruptodate. I'm at @ptsbrian. Of course, you can follow KCUR on Facebook. Steve Kraske's back here on Monday. He'll talk with Steve Paul about young Ernest Hemingway's year at the Kansas City Star. We'll also talk about the state of online grocery shopping. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music, and we had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.